worth thinking about from our experience last night and as we use our words. Marilyn writes, "The reason to read poetry takes longer to articulate. The most persuasive, if one is willing to entertain it, is that reading and writing poetry are survival skills. If we learn the skills involved in reading closely, attentively, imaginatively, if we understand the demands of a poem and respond to them, we are better equipped to negotiate flexibly, distinguish what is authentic from what is false, and make discerning decisions. But poetry demands are complex. Poems demand that we slow down, notice patterns, reckon with ambiguities, consider subtle distinctions between one term or image and its alternative, and recognize the relationship between techniques and purposes. But if we take this work on, if we practice finding paths through poems, staying with them as we tease out their possibilities, follow where they point us by allusions and suggestions, and unpack their metaphors, they can equip us to walk in any situation, look around, assess, analyze, and act. They teach us to listen more attentively to language and to reckon more astutely with the arts of persuasion. More than that, they restore to us what I believe the noise and haste of commercial cultures dulls and destroys: being attuned to subtleties of sense and feelings, being awake to the possibilities of an ordinary moment on an ordinary day. They train and exercise the imagination." So, Marilyn, welcome.
Thank you, Barbara. What a privilege to be here. It's just been very retreat-like for me, even though I have to speak, or get to speak. So today, I am planning to slow down. I had one special request that I slow down, because my tendency is to speak fast if I think there's not enough time and more than the time allows for. But actually, I keep telling classes that coverage is a false value. We never cover anything anyway. So right now, let's just assume that we're probably not going to finish everything I prepared, and that's fine, and we'll just relax into reflecting together on what it means to learn to see. Father Tom provided a perfect setup shot for this session the other day. Remember, he was talking about the woman who wipes Jesus' feet with her hair, and he said this, I think, twice: "Do you see this person?" And it was, his point was that ministry is relational, and that the antidote to legalism is to really see who's in front of you and consider what a friend of mine has called the call of the moment, and attend to the call of the moment, not call in a big sense, but what is this encounter about, and who is this with whom you're coming into relationship, even for a moment? One of the best models of that kind of seeing that I have encountered in my work with medical students is Oliver Sacks. How many of you are familiar with Oliver Sacks? Some of you. He's a neurologist who has a very large body of work at this point, and actually he recently published a piece in The New Yorker reflecting on his own impending death. He has metastatic cancer, and he knows that he doesn't have much longer to live, but he's still writing. He's as prolific as anyone I know who's living. But his basic approach to patients is, who are you? What's it like to be you? How are you already coping with what life has given you, and how can I help you with that? It's a very consultative, imaginative kind of practice. And one of his early books, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, is a beautiful series of what he calls clinical tales, which are renderings of case histories in which he himself is very present, reflecting on what was puzzling or what was surprising, or when he had to reframe his expectations. And I think Oliver Sacks has single-handedly greatly expanded the notion of what is medically relevant, so that he's a good model for med students who admittedly have very little time with patients, but who need to be taught that they can afford to hear something that seems beside the point, because it may be the point. So the reflection this morning on learning to see, to tie it into the theme of this gathering, is to say that however we understand our particular roles in the business of evangelization, bringing people into the gospel story, we really are called to see who's in front of us. This is a quotation that I had on the wall of my library, Carol, when I was dissertating in graduate school. It really helped me. It's by a musician, Roberto Gerhard. And I'll just simply read it with you. Attention, deep, sustained, undeviating, is in itself an experience of a very high order. I can't tell you how much that helped me. That and a little New Yorker cartoon that showed the sculptor sitting in front of a huge piece of rock saying, there's a statue in here somewhere. Let me read this again. Attention, deep, sustained, undeviating, is in itself an experience of a very high order. This corresponds to another observation that art doesn't tell us what to see, it shows us how to see. That in a certain sense, it doesn't matter what you're paying attention to, that attentiveness is a discipline. I was saying to someone yesterday that I love the moment in the Byzantine Mass when they're about to read the gospel and the priest holds the beautiful volume high and says, wisdom, be attentive. That's the call to the summons to attend to the gospel, but be attentive is a strong imperative. Just let everything else go and be in the present. I don't know a single wisdom tradition that I've heard of that doesn't have some core teaching about being in the present. And it can be a strenuous discipline. There is so much to distract us. Eliot talks about modern man as distracted from distraction by distraction. Pretty accurate line. The eye is the lamp of the body. So then, if your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light. I've always thought that was an amazing line. If your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light. There are neurologists who are working on the proposition that the whole body is a site of intelligence, that we know with our bodies, that we have what they call cellular memory. But the eye is where we take in and register the information that the body then processes, not just the brain. So there's a kind of anatomical wisdom in this. It reminds me of a story I read years ago, an autobiography by a man who had gone blind, and for the life of me, I can't relocate it. It's one of those things where you don't remember the author and you don't remember the title, so you're kind of a little lost trying to find it again. But I remember the story vividly, which was that some months after adapting to being blind, he began to have an experience that he described as seeing, and he said, of course, the other senses kick in. Let there be light. Let there be light? Yes. Would you write that down for me? Yes. Thank you. It's amazing. So he starts to see with his whole body. And of course, it isn't the same as visual seeing, but it's also not just that his hearing and so on become more acute. It is that he experiences light. So that just is to say that when we hear stories like that, they can be reminders that seeing is a much more comprehensive and complex experience than we imagine. when we restrict it to the eye. We are such a visual culture. We tend anyway to subordinate the other senses. But so I think to see with your whole being comes back to this matter of being attentive, being oriented toward. Can you think of other verbs besides be attentive, be oriented toward, that might be ways of saying what it is to see with the whole self?
Apprehend.
Thank you.
Present.
To be present.
Receive.
Pardon?
Receive.
To receive. Yes, receptivity is part of attentiveness. Somebody else said? To be mindful. That's a word that's getting a lot of circulation now, and I like it. It's one of those words that connects us with Eastern practices, and it's an import in a certain way, but mindfulness is a big word. Yeah. And then this line from Michel Coist, I thought it was Thomas Merton, but anyway, it's from a poem by a French monk who writes, "In my heaven, there will be only 5-year-old eyes." Which is to say, it's a long poem, and it reflects on the way children see. We've all had that experience of a child's sustained gaze. The little kids, before they lose it or before they've been photographed so much that they are used to posturing, which really makes me sad. I have a whole rant about photography that I won't go into at the moment, but I don't actually think photography, the sort of promiscuous photography that is practiced by people with iPhones, is necessarily helping us see each other. But I do think that the way children see is a kind of unabashed curiosity, the long gaze that is unembarrassed to encounter, that has nothing particular to hide, that really enters the world with that question, who are you? What are you about? And that each encounter is rich with possibility. What's up now? I mean, we've all got stories about small children in our lives, but I remember a little walk I took with one of my grandchildren when he was about 2. He had a particular fondness for trees. You know, we live in California. He was a natural little tree hugger. He literally would go up to particular trees. I don't know how they called to him, but he'd just stop. He'd let go of your hand and go put his little arms around the tree and put his head on it and hang out there for a minute or two. And then he was done, and we'd go on with our walk. But one time we stopped next to a cedar tree that seemed to be one of his friends. And he said, "Amma, what is the tree doing?" I thought that was a pretty cool question. So I did my little number about oxygen and carbon dioxide and how when we breathe, we create carbon dioxide, and that's what the trees need. And when they breathe, they make oxygen, and that's what we need. So we give breath to each other and so on. So we went on with our walk, and when we came back, he stopped by the same tree, and he stood still, and he went, it's like giving the tree an extra hit. But I was very struck by the way he singled out particular trees and just went into this whole relational moment with them. There's something to learn from that, I think, which reminds me of the 5-year-old eyes. And I love this word about seeing. Guide us, O God, by your word and Holy Spirit, that in your light we may see light. This occurs regularly in Presbyterian liturgy. I don't know where it fits into Catholic liturgy, but it's such a beautiful prayer, that in your light we may see light. One of my poems that I think I included part of later about Vermeer was focusing on how what we see is always the light. When we talk about people's radiance, I don't think that's just a metaphor. We do radiate. You've seen Carillion photography that sort of registers the heat that's coming from the body, and we are sources of heat and light. And so I think radiance is a good word to think about when we think about the quality of encounter that we hope for. And here's an image of seeing light. This is one of those images of the chakras. But the idea that the body, that we have energetic bodies, that the body is an energy system, that mind and body, or mind, spirit, and body are not really separable entities, that's been an important one for me in working with medical people, working with people who do Eastern practices, Chinese medicine. I think there's a lot to learn from the Asian traditions about how to think about body, mind, spirit, and the anatomy of the spirit, so to speak. But that there, that we have, we all know this intuitively, right? That when you come into somebody's energy field, something is exchanged. We all have the experience of someone walking into a room and lightening it, or the opposite. I had a student this summer in a month-long May term course who was a real challenge. She was sullen. She didn't want to be there. As soon as she walked into the room, there was a heaviness that she brought with her. I tried to talk with her one-to-one. She was resistant. But one of the challenges for me was not to let myself be dragged down into her pit. And so that's something to consider in encounter too, that when we take each other's energy fields into account, we have to figure out how to navigate that space. And one of the disciplines was to try to see her in terms of whatever pain had gotten her there. That was a helpful idea. It didn't provide me with a completely sufficient shield, but I certainly think that those of us who work with people in hospitals or prisons or places where they're deeply stressed people who are angry, you know, suffering isn't always just pathos. Sometimes it's anger, and sometimes it's hostility, and sometimes it's aggressive. And so to stay in a place of seeing that as a form of suffering, I think, is a profound and important discipline to practice, and it's really not an easy one. This is Vermeer's Lace Maker. This is a line from a poem by Auden, which I'll read you a little more of in the next slide. But this was the first of the Vermeer poems I wrote. We were living in exile in New Jersey at the time. And it was a February afternoon that was really muddy, snowy, icky. And this woman hung on our wall. We had a big print of it. And I sort of consoled myself on a particularly dreary afternoon by sitting in front of it and writing a poem, which was the beginning of this whole journey of writing in response to paintings. I've used these in courses to invite people to consider three things. One is, what do you know about the young woman? What information does the artist provide? Secondly, what do you know about the artist, or what can you infer about the one whose gaze sees her in this way? And thirdly, how does this representation of this woman bring you to terms with something in yourself as you consider your own response to her? What feelings does it evoke? What do you find yourself noticing? What do you find yourself resisting? I think any work of art, of course, has that element of Rorschach blot in it. But let me just open that up for you for a moment to ask you first, what do we know about her or feel that we know about her? What do we like about her? Are we curious about? Because Vermeer's art really does invite narrativizing, that this woman has some kind of story, life. The task is very small for her big hands, right? So there's something that has to be brought to a point here. There's a skill involved that involves a discipline of herself. It really provides or confers a respect on what she's doing that I find in all of his portraits of women. This is 17th century Holland. And women were actually more involved in public culture than in some places, but still, to the kind of profound respect he confers on women in his many portraits of women invites respect for what they do. Sister. Yes. Yes. That's a lovely observation, that the parting of her hair and of course that hair, I wouldn't want to wear my hair like that, but that hair really suggests effort and care and some concern for self-presentation, although in this portrait she's deeply concerned with something other than self. So there's a kind of getting lost in the experience that is part of inviting us to reflect on what attention looks like. Yes?
I was drawn to the hands too, probably because I have three sisters who are all artists with their hands. I don't have that gift, but I so appreciated it in them.
Yes. You know, I have read and heard from medical students who have entered into their first year where they work with a human corpse for the first time, that the hardest thing, of course, they work with, when they work with the body, it's covered except for the part they're working on in their anatomy courses, but a number of them have said the hardest thing is the hands. Because the hands tell so much about the life, or you just imagine what those hands have done. You would think the hardest thing might be the face, but most of them say the hands are the expressive, the moment when they have to come to terms with the fact that this is a person with a story. Yes? Yes. Yeah. Right. There's something in that bright yellow and the lace collar that is full of self-respect. She's clearly a middle-class burger's wife, probably, or daughter. And she's okay with herself. Right. This is not a shrinking woman. There's a great deal of dignity in what we see here. So just to shift the question a little bit, I've said some things about my respect for the way Vermeer presents his subjects, but what might you infer here about the artist, his values, his concerns, his pleasures, his interests? Yes. Right. Right. He's very meticulous, and he invites us to notice that. If you think about a work of art, any work of art, poetry, art, sculpture, as invitation, a question that I always ask in literature courses when we start a new work is, what does this writer invite you to do? And what does the writer require of you is another good one. But what does this artist invite you to do, and what do we know about him? We have a relationship with the one who saw her this way. Yes.
I think he's inviting us to ponder just the ordinary, everyday life.
Yes. And of course, that is a distinctive of the Dutch art in the 17th century, that it focuses on ordinary life and dignifies it. You remember his milkmaid. You know, he has a number of paintings of people doing very ordinary things. Why do you imagine that?
I see a little girl there, her hair, but with her big hands, she's probably involved in making money working with her hands.
Right, and that's a really interesting observation. If you didn't hear her, she said this may be an artist who's interested in the poor. Not that this girl is necessarily poor, but she may be involved in making money with her hands. And actually, the Dutch in the 17th century were very much involved in a commercial environment. They were becoming the great world navigators, and everyone was involved in commerce, and women became part of that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Respects her, yes, but he's trying to figure her out.
Yes. And this curiosity about women, I think, is an interesting idea, that this kind of tenderness and respect that he brings to women. There is the theory that the girl with the pearl earring, his probably most famous portrait, is one of his daughters. They don't know that. In the movie they made about the girl with the pearl earring, she's a servant. But yes, he's fascinated with women's lives. If you don't know this about Vermeer, he only had a corpus of about 35 works. That may be because he had 11 children. but he was a Protestant who married a Catholic woman. I don't know if he personally converted, but he moved to the Catholic section of Delft and worked from there. And that's there is a lovely book about Vermeer and faith. And certainly there's a lot to say about how his art invites particular faith perspectives. This is part of the poem from W.H. Auden's Hours, and the sext poem that, from which I took that line about how beautiful it is, the eye on the object look. You need not see what someone is doing to know if it is his vocation. You have only to watch his eyes. A cook mixing a sauce. A surgeon making a primary incision. A clerk completing a bill of lading. Wear the same rapt expression, forgetting themselves in a function. That seems to me to be a fairly good description of the woman we just saw. But I wonder if you could add to that list. All of us have had that experience of witnessing someone or being someone deeply engaged in, so deeply engaged in what we're doing that we lose ourselves, which is an experience of a very high order. But we've also witnessed that, right? I wonder if you have observations about where you've seen that eye on the object look and how beautiful it is. Yeah.
In our monastery, Sister Terry, going out into a tall grass prairie that we have planted and letting the flowers speak to her and deciding which ones will be part of the bouquet in front of the altar.
Oh. Did you all hear that?
No.
She was, maybe we should find a microphone, but also I'll just say she's speaking of a sister in their monastery who goes out to pick bouquets for the altar, letting the flowers speak to her. I love that. And the attentiveness with which she selects flowers for these bouquets. That's a lovely illustration. Any others that you think of? The experience of witnessing the eye on the object? Yes.
Last night, you know, Jennifer?
Yeah, I think.
Remarkable that just looking at her as she read the poem,
mm-hmm.
her presence to us brought the presence of those people she ministered.
Yes. That was lovely to hear this young woman read her poems. And as you say, the poems, too, are about her presence to these patients. And that the poems are a way of kind of registering and processing that encounter. Yeah, it was lovely.
Even the girl that sung the Ave Maria, her hands, expression, her body, everything about her was graceful. It was like a song.
Yeah, it was like she was in the song, right? And this slang expression of being into something, you know, you can laugh about it, but I think it's really a very thoughtful, interesting way of describing what it is to be in that place of deep attention. Here she is. This is just a little section from one of my poems about her, but this is another one that I have presented to various kinds of courses. I teach a course on portraiture and personhood in literature and art, and she's one of the first portraits that I feature. There's a black background, unlike the lace maker, and unlike many of his other portraits. He just situates her in ambiguous space, but it's clearly a moment in time. The temporality of this, the kind of the vanishing moment that we're in. She has just turned or is just turning. Something has just happened. It's almost impossible not to infer something here. But it is certainly an invitation to see her and to recognize that there's some mystery about her that we don't have full access to. You know, I think most of us have the experience of someone thinking they have us pegged. Yeah, I know what you're going to say. To which my immediate response is, no, you don't. You know, even people who have known me for many years, how can we not resist that? And so I think one of the ways he invites us into a kind of contemplative moment is to realize when we look at this young woman, we don't know what she's going to say. But so, without reading my... by the way, do you want me to dim the lights a little bit more? Is this sufficiently visible? Okay. Is that better?
Yeah.
Sorry. So let me just, you know, again, holding those questions, what do we know about her? What do we know about the artist? And what do we recognize in ourselves as we respond to her? Any of those ways of framing what you see, what do you imagine? What does it evoke? Yes.
What I notice is, I wonder what the hair is like.
Yeah.
I mean, the artist could have made that smooth.
Right.
No, there are some little bumps in there and ridges. It makes me wonder what the hair is like.
Yeah, maybe she has curly hair and that's the only way she can deal with it. but a lot of women, of course, wore turbans, and at that point, people didn't wash... Right. Yeah, remember yesterday we were talking about seeing in terms of process or recognizing process. And here, that's one of the many details that tell you there was a process here. She had to stuff some hair under that turban. That's a really lovely detail to notice. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Her eyes, the clothes are real plain, the black background, that blue right next to her face.
Yes.
There is one of your eyes there.
Right. So the muted colors really invite us to look at her face. There's a kind of modesty about her and the way she's dressed, even though there's also a lavishness to it. But the painting does say, look at her face. Yes.
I believe in this era, still when Vermeer was painting, blue was still a very expensive color. And the artists, if I'm not mistaken, reserved blue for what they regarded as the most important aspect of the painting or portrait they were trying to depict and show. So there's a symbolism in why he put the blue in the turban.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you all heard that, but he was saying that at this point, blue was a very expensive color, and artists would reserve it for important paintings. Also, traditionally, at least in Italian and other European art, which the Dutch must have known about, blue was often a color associated with the Virgin Mary. And many of Vermeer's secular women have echo other representations of the Virgin Mary. So it really invites us in his Dutch Protestant way to connect all women with the mother of all of us, the mother of God.
I really just have to share this. One of our sisters, Sister Marie Therese, died recently. And on the back of her funeral program, there were three photos of her, one at 20 in that exact pose, Huh. One at 60 and one in her 80s. When the sister died, there were 600 people at her funeral. Mm. And I think she was a woman who carried the charism of the visitation. And in the look in her eye when she was 20 was the same as when she was 80-something that we will always treasure, that she carried something. She knew something about that mystery of the visitation.
I love that phrase, that she carried the charism of the visitation. And really, what a wonderful phrase to carry with you as you come into encounters with people, that they are carrying something. And to carry a charism, to be a bearer of something into this encounter, is a way of reminding ourselves that we're encountering mystery in the other. Just one more question about her before we move on. It's an interesting question to consider how you narrativize the painting, how you are inclined to consider whether she's turning toward or turning away from. Yes. Looking back for some kind of affirmation before she moves forward. Okay, so there's uncertainty. That's a possibility. Yeah.
For me, she is full of hope and full of future. And to me, it's an invitation to go with her.
Oh, that's lovely. It's an invitation to go with her. Uh-huh. You see her as full of hope. Other possibilities? So the open mouth suggesting that she's about to say something, and it makes us want to imagine what she might be about to say. She's clearly a young woman on the verge of maturing, on the verge of saying something, on the verge of moving in a particular direction, turning away, turning toward. But the part of what is so exquisite about this painting is not simply that she is beautiful, but that she's not simply beautiful. There's much more to her than meets the eye. One small detail about this too, I had the great privilege some years ago of seeing the original in the Mauritshuis in just outside Amsterdam, The Hague. And I don't think that you can see it in this reproduction, but that light in her earring actually contains an image of the window across the room. So you see the light source. You see the bars of the window. So it's the place in the painting where you get a sense of the space she inhabits. Just an interesting detail.
May I make one more comment?
Yes.
2 years ago, this was on exhibit in a museum in Atlanta in September, and I drove down to see it as an excuse to get a car I wanted in Florida. This painting is not very large.
No, it's a small painting.
But it was so surrounded by young people staring at the painting, I couldn't get close to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it drew all these young people to it. Boys and girls. And they were a chatty bunch, but they all had to get close to it to see it. And I was trying to figure out what was drawing the kids.
Mm-hmm. Did you all hear that? That he went to see the original in Atlanta, and there was a whole group of young people who kind of wouldn't go away. I certainly think she has her being on the verge of maturing. The sense that there is a there is part of what's fascinating about her. It is so easy to be, to think sociologically. Some of you know that Flannery O'Connor had not much good to say about sociology or sociologists. She makes them the villains in a number of her stories, which if any of you are sociologists, I apologize for O'Connor. But still, she has a point to make, which is we get used to seeing each other in terms of sort of as cultural groups and in terms of particular patterns of behavior that we can then make into statistics and so on. And this just defies that. You don't get to say, oh, she's a young woman, it's a portrait of a young woman, move on. There's so much more here than her class, any classification you could put her into. So I think that there's a way in which part of our work is to resist the ways we stereotype or catalog or categorize or use the various kinds of very useful techniques that psychology and sociology have provided us with, and allow people to remind us that there is a mystery that defies categories.
I have a question.
Yes.
Do you think that maybe this is one of your own daughters?
That's one theory. Nobody really knows, but people have imagined that, first of all, they were not wealthy, and so models cost money. We know that Rembrandt used his wife and son over and over, and some of his neighbors, and certainly himself, lots of self-portraits. So it would make sense that she was either a daughter or a servant, someone he had access to without having to pay too much. So just this section from my poem was one of my efforts to get at what I was seeing. Neither eager nor reluctant, not defensive, not submissive, willing, womanly, to utter her fiat mihi in her own time. I wanted somehow to connect her with that moment when Mary saw the angel. And it might have looked something like that. But there's some way she's not quite submissive, but she isn't resistant either. She is considering. She's a woman who keeps her own counsel. This is another great, he only painted, I think, two portraits of men. This is called The Astronomer. And I paired with it these lines from a poem by Robert Lowell, where I'm trying to think of the name of the poem. It's about art, and he says, "Pray for the grace of accuracy Vermeer gave to the sun's illumination, stealing like the tide across a map." I picked those partly because I love the phrase, the grace of accuracy. Remember yesterday we were talking about precision and the discipline of precision and the gift of precision. And so you don't see it quite as well in this painting as some of the others, but in many of his interior paintings, there's a map in the background. It's a lot of iconography here, but it's not an art history course, so we're not going to do that. But still, there are many of them in which there is light coming from a window onto a painting, suggesting the world they inhabit as 17th century Dutch living in a culture of navigation. But also, there's such a grace of accuracy, again, in the representation of the moment, and again, the eye on the object look, the intense focus of this person, such dignity in looking at someone at work in terms of their engagement with their work. A lot to say about this one too, but just briefly, what do you feel you're invited to here, to recognize, to honor, to wonder about? I'm sorry, this isn't The Astronomer, it's The Geographer. The Astronomer has pardon me for that, it's The Geographer. Yes?
I want to know what's on the other side of the window.
If he is looking out the window, it's hard to tell, but yes. And all those windows do, like the maps, suggest a world outside that impinges and informs, but what we're invited into is the interior. One thing to notice about this, which is true of many of his other interiors, where there is interior space, is that there's a barrier between the viewer and the person who's depicted, which people have read in various ways, but it does suggest that in a way we are invading his privacy and we need to keep some distance, that the viewer is put at a respectful distance. Yes. Yes, always looking toward the light. There's a movement from darkness into light. This is so true of Rembrandt also, of course, you know, how his figures emerge from the darkness. I mean, Holland was a dark place. A lot of the year it was a dark place, so light was precious. Well, you're in Minnesota, you know that. I mean, we don't really get enough darkness or rain at home. I'm thrilled with the rain. But that relationship of darkness to light, in the sense that light is something bestowed and given and light as a gift, is really present in these paintings. And of course, it's almost as though the objects themselves are light sources. You do see things in terms of a certain quality of radiance. So we go to another Dutch painter, Van Gogh, about whom there is also much to say, and who also invites us to see light, to see objects as light sources, to see objects as bearers and people as bearers of light. There are many, many self-portraits. Again, self-portraits are cheap, right? You don't have to hire a model. But Van Gogh's self-portraits are an extraordinary autobiography. And again, they say to the viewer, look again. Look again. Consider who is here. This is a late self-portrait, and it certainly has pathos in it. This is a piece of one of my poem about this painting, but before we go there, just consider again what you are invited to recognize. Yes.
The brush strokes in the face all radiate out away from his eyes.
The brush strokes in the face, she said, all radiate out away from his eyes. And you did get such such a strong sense of outward energy too, and the movement in the air. One of the things that I think is consistent in Van Gogh's paintings is the way liquid, solid, and gas tend to merge. You don't get strong boundaries, and you do get a sense that light permeates, and that what is solid and what is not, what is material and what is spiritual, what is stationary and what's in movement, are quite permeable and even inseparable. And so you begin to see all of it in terms of movement. That we are seeing someone when we see them at a moment in their story comes back to something I remember saying yesterday about seeing the world as verbs, that if we see verbs rather than nouns, like little Benjamin who said, Amma, what is the tree doing? Now, if we asked ourselves that about the nearest tree, I think we would begin to see the flora of the area a little differently. The tree certainly is doing something. And so here too, what is happening in the painting is happening in him, on him, around him. But I think that it really invites us to reconsider those prepositions that we use to organize, but sometimes artificially to divide one thing from another. I'll just read you this bit of the poem about him. There were winters of discontent. Money was scarce, and hunger only thinly disguised by decent attire. Still, even the darkest day that December offered its tithe of color. Muted yellow and soft green-gray lent their energies to his practice of presence. And the face, where red-orange flickers defiant against what damps and dulls, draws to itself all available sun. A long, slow burning keeps it alive like a vigil lamp, trimmed and watchful in the cavernous dark. If you haven't read Van Gogh's letters to his brother Theo, they're a good read. I suggest them for the pile on the bedside table. They're really quite moving. He was a deeply spiritual person. His father was a Dutch pastor. He wrestled with Calvinism. He had a vexed relationship with the church, as with family and pretty much everything else. But there's a longing in him that's consistently moving and informative, I think, again, to see people on the journeys, that if we see others as at a moment in their journey, we see them more adequately, I think. This is a recent painting, obviously, and I failed to put the artist's name down. I'd have to find it again. I'm going to read the poem first this time. This is a section from a poem by Richard Wilbur called The Eye. Richard Wilbur was poet laureate for a while. And in his poem, The Eye, it's two sections. In the first section of the poem, he tells about looking through a telescope at a person on a neighboring boat when they were out on a boat somewhere in a harbor, and noticing and then realizing that he was being a voyeur, just realizing that when you put yourself behind a lens and extend your vision into places it doesn't ordinarily go, maybe you're exceeding what's given to us to see. You know, the church has always had these warnings about the occult and about, you know, really asking us to consider what is given to us to know, to see, to do, and just be careful about the ways in which we exceed that. The second part of the poem is a prayer to Saint Lucy, and this is part of that. Preserve us, Lucy, from the eye's nonsense. You, by whom benighted Dante was beheld, to whom he was beholden. If the salesman's head rolls on the seat back of the bus in ugly sleep, his open mouth banjo strung with spittle, forbid my vision to take itself for a curious angel. Remind me that I am here in body, a passenger and rumpled. I love that poem. That's only one section of it. But just consider what this painting invites us to consider. And I imagine somebody's going to ask what that script coming out of his mouth says, and I'll tell you right now, I don't know. It's very difficult to see. I imagine if we saw it in the original, we could tell. Yes.
It's a very painful portrayal of poverty.
Of?
Poverty.
Oh, poverty, yes.
It reminds me of being in Rome several years back, and the beggars on the streets sliding down. It's just very painful. People are moving away.
Yes. They cannot tolerate it. And actually, I think it's important that you start with the observation it's very painful. You know, what does this writer, what does this artist invite us to do? What does this artist require of us? Is a really important question, I think, when you look at art or poetry. And what this requires of us is to be willing to sustain our gaze. It is so, I mean, clearly it's all about the averted gaze, the moving away from, the not wanting to see.
I was just thinking what Father Thomas said yesterday, and he started this with, do you see this person?
Yeah.
Do you see this person?
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the dark glasses suggest either that he's blind or partially blind, but also the veiled eyes make it that much harder to see, that there, it's a clear barrier. Encounter really would take something strenuous.
Even the dog objects to me.
Yeah. Right, even the dog is turning away. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Even in the stories of Rich Man and Lazarus, the dogs at least come and lick the wounds. But here, even the dog is turning away.
Right, right. So we see him in terms of his abandonment. And we see him in terms of his poverty, his pathos, his humiliation. One of the things I remember from an early literature and medicine course I taught at Mills College, where there were women of various ages, we had a fairly large population of returning students, was I happened to have in this class three disabled women, two of whom were in wheelchairs all the time, one of whom walked with crutches part of the time. And so I just asked them to talk with us one day about the experience of disability and what were just some of the daily things they had to deal with. And the first thing one of them said was, people look down at, if you're in a wheelchair, people look down at you all the time. And she said, we use that as a metaphorical expression, but there's a powerful sense of chronic humiliation when people look down at you all the time. So she said, my request to any of you is when you talk with me or any other person in a wheelchair, if you possibly can, sit down. Because meeting people eye to eye is so important. And I think that the vantage point here where we too are looking down at him situates us uncomfortably in that position of the superior. This is a continuation of the prayer to St. Lucy from the previous page by Richard Wilbur. So I'm going to read that. This is a self-portrait by a disabled artist. And he prays, charge me to see in all bodies the beat of spirit, not merely in the tout en l'air or double pike with layout, but in the strong shouldering gait of the legless man, the calm walk of the blind young woman whose cane touches the curbstone. Correct my view that the far mountain is much diminished, that the fovea is prime composer, that the lid's closure frees me. Let me be touched by the alien hands of love forever, that this eye not be folly's loophole, but giver of due regard. Well, I want to do just a little kind of quasi-lexio moment with you for a moment and focus on the poem rather than the painting and ask you just to pick your favorite line or phrase. Where does it stop you? Where does it invite you? Where does it remind you? Remembering that it's a prayer.
Correct my view.
Mm-hmm. Correct my view.
In all bodies, the beat of spirit.
Yes, in all bodies, the beat of spirit. That comes back to that verb, seeing as. Seeing nouns as verbs.
By the alien hands of love forever.
Lovely oxymoron there.
Giver of due regard.
Giver of due regard. Isn't that a lovely, that is the end of the poem. And it's a lovely last line that's what I want to be, is a giver of due regard. Regard is such a modest word, isn't it? But when you read 19th century fiction, you know, regard really is something of high value, that people hold each other in high esteem or regard. And then to turn to the painting for a moment, as a self-portrait of a disabled man, what do you think it invites? Yes.
I'm thinking of seeing him as someone beyond a person in a wheelchair, a person who's observing the meaning.
I didn't hear the very last thing you said.
I see him as someone.
Yes, good. That's it. Even though this figure takes up almost half the painting, we are not invited to see him as the object of our gaze, but rather as a gazer, someone who sees, not simply as someone who is seen. And as a self-portrait, I think that's a really interesting diversionary tactic. To say, yes, you may look at me, but look beyond me. Look at what I am doing. Look at my eye on the object. Yes.
What's beyond, like his wheelchair looks broken to me, and what's beyond looks like a tree has no leaves in the,
right.
in the distance. So life is right here, right now.
That's lovely.
That's the broken behind.
Did you all hear that? That's a lovely reading of the painting, that all the life-giving color, the sense of life is right here, right now, is in the foreground, and then what is in the background is kind of desolate and dead. So the larger world is a difficult and desolate place, but what's right here, including this body with its artificial hand, and maybe both hands, and its shrunkenness, is still represented in these lively colors. He's doing life, and he's watching.
In other words, the bit of his text or whatever is going to bleed him because right now he's caught.
Wow. It's so, I love doing this in groups because people do such very different readings of what they see. Okay, let's move to seeing the natural world. Any Annie Dillard fans here? I love Annie Dillard. I want to write like Annie before I die. She's a woman who has taught me a lot about how to see, and she has, I think, a very lively theological imagination, tremendous love of words, playful imagination. I had a big argument with one of my colleagues one time who's a great fan of John Muir, and he himself is a mountaineer. And I have respect for John Muir, but I thought Annie Dillard was better, so we were having our Dillard versus Muir conversation. And one of the things he said was, she's just a little too dazzling. And I thought, what's wrong with dazzling? I love being dazzled, so I'm dazzled. But anyway, this is a passage from her chapter called Intricacy in Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. The question from agnosticism is, who turned on the lights? The question from faith is, whatever for? Thoreau climbs Mount Katahdin. This, by the way, is a representation of Mount Katahdin in Maine. Thoreau climbs Mount Katahdin and gives vent to an almost outraged sense of the reality of the things of this world. Quote, I fear bodies. I tremble to meet them. What is this Titan that has possession of me? Talk of mysteries. Think of our life in nature, daily to be shown matter, to come in contact with it, rocks, trees, wind on our cheeks, the solid earth, the actual world, the common sense, contact, contact. Who are we? Where are we? The Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, he knoweth. That's last bit is Dillard. So, this is pretty rhapsodic, but still, to restore a sense of mystery is part of what people of faith are challenged with, since we have managed to reduce pretty much everything in the material environment to commodity. I mean, Native tribes people don't have any notion, or haven't had historically, of ownership of land, for instance. You have territory. It's your tribal territory. It's given to you to inhabit, but you don't buy and sell it because it can't be bought and sold any more than the air or the sea. But now, of course, we do sell the air, the airwaves, and the sea, and pretty much everything else we can possibly name. So retrieving a sense of the non-commodity, that the ways in which people and things cannot be commodified is a bigger and bigger challenge. We are taught to think of ourselves as consumers before we think of ourselves as citizens, and certainly before we think of ourselves as children of God or as mysterious beings. So Thoreau's outraged sense of the reality of things of this world, this is an interesting use of the term outrage, that it's just too much. How can we possibly take this in? What is this assignment anyway? It's too big to grasp. But outrage here is represented as a variety of awe. Any observations about the representation of the mountain before we move on? Again, it's an invitation to see the mountain in certain terms.
Well, I'm struck by the V-shaped penetration of light.
Yes.
As if an abstract depiction of the shape of the mountains around the mountain she really wants to, or the artist really wants to portray.
Right, that V-shaped line that cuts through almost suggests that we're peering at this mountain from a cleft in a rock somewhere, and yet we see the whole mountain. So it gives us two different possible ways of apprehending the mountain. It's also as though a veil is parting, and so we see it in terms of a kind of revelation. We see it in terms of its planes of light and color. Certainly, most of the history of modern art since the late 19th century has to do with taking away something so that we can see what we see in new terms, that our vision is corrected so we don't think, as Richard Wilbur puts it, that the fovea is prime composer, that what our eyes see is the way things are. It isn't. Yes. And that's a pretty wild and interesting way of seeing it, isn't it? It's almost like one of those Escher prints where if you adjust your vision and allow for a kind of fantasy here, the mountain coming downward is an exhilarating idea.
Like stalactites and stalagmites.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are we below ground or above?
Yeah. And that somehow the earth is being penetrated by this light. This is one of Van Gogh's trees. His trees are just wild with life. And I've always liked the idea that his sun is more solid than the things on the earth are. So again, this kind of exchange of energetic and material value, mass and energy, tend to interpenetrate in his paintings. And here, of course, the air is as solid as the earth, and the earth seems to be liquid. And the trees seem to be verging. This is a section from a poem I wrote about this one. Each tree is an act of courage, holding its own, making peace with the heat and dry ground, forbearing while mountains not yet made low rise like monuments to what may be born. This painting has become particularly moving to me in a period of very, very serious drought. I mean, I grew up in California and we've always had droughts, but this one is scary. It's scary. The aquifers are way down and the trees in front of our house along the street are suffering. It is hard not to see the trees in terms of what they are suffering. And so to come back to this poem is to notice the word forbearing, that they are forbearing, and that there's a kind of courage in continuing to grow. One thing I read about oak trees in William Logan Bryant's book called Oaks is that when oak trees are in groves, if one of them is sick, the roots of the others will connect with it and give it nutrients. They kind of take care of each other. Isn't that a wild and lovely thing to know about oak trees? We're almost out of time. I do want to get to one abstract painting. An artist at Westmont College, where I taught, Tony Askew, who's very well known regionally and I think nationally for his monotypes and prints, came to me with a series of 15 of these a few years ago and said, I know you write poems about art, and I wonder if you could write some to go with this set of prints. We had this vision of doing a publication that hasn't happened yet because it's on the back burner. But I was a little taken aback because I thought, you know, I've done like Vermeer, Rembrandt, Van Gogh, those are paintings of people and things. But I said, okay. And it was a wonderful assignment. I had so much fun with this. Tony is a person of great faith, and so it was hard not to see these paintings in somewhat theological or biblical terms. And so I'll just read the poem, partly because I'm trying to be attentive to time, and then maybe ask you what you notice in this monotype. Hover over the waters and see how the spirit blows and broods. The sea and all its creatures still crash and tumble at the edge of their silences. The sun rises and sinks below the waves. The curved ocean clings to Earth's edge, obedient except where something urges it upward. That's not the whole poem, but I did see it in terms of those allusions, the scriptural moments. So just, I'm curious, really, what do you see when you look at this? The poem kind of imposes my vision of it, but I wonder what calls itself to your attention or what you feel it invites you to do or consider. Yes.
I don't see water. I see prairie with a green elevator.
You're so Midwest. I don't know if you all heard that. She said she doesn't see water. She sees prairie with a grain elevator. Were you going to say more about that?
Well, I grew up with, in a part of the country where that was the common view of any small town. It had its elevator, and it had its surrounding wheat fields. And it kind of reminds me of home.
You know, it kind of reminds me of home, too. I grew up next to the ocean. So, you know, though, what that exchange reminds me of is Paul Klee saying, we don't see things the way they are. We see things the way we are. And it's just such an important reminder. We don't see things the way they are. We see things the way we are. And so that's why we need each other. We need to interpret in community. We need the correction that the fovea is not the prime composer. An image of the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is as though there's enormous scope that can't be contained in the size of the painting and has to be suggested. And of course, the geometrical imposition of geometrical form also reminds us that we are, that this is artifice, that whatever we're seeing here, we are putting boundaries around it that aren't there. Well, I think, Barbara, it's time to stop, right? So let me just do one more painting. Yeah, it's time to stop, so I'm not going to because I had a whole lot of other stuff. But I just wanted to end with Rembrandt's. Do I have time for that? Rembrandt's Head of Christ. I so love this. It was just hard not to share it with you. And I'll read a bit of the poem that I wrote about this. He did two heads of Christ, but this one I think is remarkable for its compassion. I think it's interesting in the way the eyes look in different directions, the slant of the head. So he looked at the leper like this, imagining the man's life before he changed it. He looked at the centurion and saw what it must be for a father to watch his child die. He looked at the woman at the well, saw her five husbands, and sent her home with a promise. At the woman caught in adultery and did not condemn her. At the woman weeping at his feet, knowing she knew him who walked the dusty earth, unrecognized, and honored her extravagance. Okay, that's where we have to stop. Thank you so much.
That's where we have to stop. Sounds punitive. No, thank you very much for helping us to begin to think about seeing. We're going to take a 15-minute break, come back, and then I'm going to do a presentation with you on illuminating ministry, learning to see Christ in your ministry. So 15 minutes. Yeah. And was there a button?
There's a thing down here that he turned on, or I think Bailey knows what to push.